Second case this morning, McDonald v. City of Wichita, Kansas. Mr. Peterson, Mr. Keeley.
May it please the court. My name is Don Peterson. My partner Sean McGivern and I'm not sure which way to point yet, are here representing Marion McDonald, who's also here in the back. This is a Title VII retaliation case. It was tried a year ago. The City of Wichita hired my client to be the chief prosecutor, and she was there for 12 years before her job was eliminated. The city took the position that her position was eliminated due to budget problems. Mary contends that it was in retaliation for her subordinate having brought a gender discrimination claim against the city attorney, Mary's direct report. We had a trial about this. This appeal is about two aspects of the jury instructions. The first one is that the court instructed that in order for the jury to find for the plaintiff, it had to find that the retaliatory motive was the but-for cause of the termination. And this was an issue that was highlighted to the court that after both sides had submitted instructions, there was a joint set put together by the parties highlighting the areas of difference with footnotes to what each side thought was the reason that their view of it was right. It was literally highlighted with yellow. Okay, in a single combined set. This was given to the trial judge. Trial judge made the ruling that it was going to be the but-for. We had said a but-for. Both sides cited to the Nassar case, the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in 2012.
Where they use the.
Well, in the holding, they say a. The last paragraph, they say they use both throughout the case. Yeah. They're sloppy. When you're referring to something, sometimes you say the. They're referring to the standard.
And we held the use of the was okay also, didn't we, in Harley versus Potter?
Which case?
Harley versus Potter, 2011, 416 Federal Appendix 748.
Well.
And don't we look at the instruction as a whole?
Well, in that case, okay, I know the case you're talking about. In that case, the trial court had specifically told the jury that sole cause was not the standard. So,
well, you were permitted to argue. You were not foreclosed in arguing that.
Yeah, but I didn't get to sit in a robe and tell the jury that it didn't mean what it said. The is singular.
You could have argued that. And look, that's one of them.
Sure, I could.
Did you?
No, because the jury instruction said the. So we tried to argue it was the cause. But in that case, the court said it was harmless. The court didn't approve the use of the. The court said it was harmless because the trial judge said, look, it's not a sole cause standard. Our judge did not say that.
Did the defense argue that it is a sole cause standard?
They didn't use those words, but they did take advantage of that language in the jury instruction.
And what do you mean take advantage?
Well,
they
emphasized that there were 1,000 reasons that this had, or 1,000,000 reasons this decision was made. That was in the closing argument to the jury. There were 1,000,000 reasons, and there's all these reasons, and that it suggests, look, obviously this isn't the one reason, the reason you're talking about, plaintiff. So let me provide, you know, sometimes abstractions can be confusing, and I think it helps to give a concrete example. And what I'd like to do is highlight how this instruction could have made so much difference to a jury decision in this case. The city says it's budget. We have budget problems. This is why it happened. We argue that the motive was retaliation. And I submit to you it could have been both.
Well, except that's your second point. And she was, are you trying to get us to say that perceived retaliation is the same as, or perceived involvement is the same as actual involvement?
Yes.
Okay. And if you didn't have, you know, if you didn't have any involvement, then you're going to lose.
Right.
Because perceived involvement has never been adopted.
Well,
and then
I think this court has
difference.
Implicitly accepted perceived because you've approved anticipatory retaliation, and that can only be because of I'm anticipating or perceiving that they're going to.
That's a totally different situation. That was the case where the plaintiff's fiance or wife had a problem, and they took it out on him on the other party, didn't they? And that's more than merely perceived.
Well, no, I'm talking about the Seuss, the Salt Lake case, anticipatory, where the boss fired the person out of fear that they were going to report them, and so the conduct that was retaliated against hadn't even happened yet, and I think that's based on a perception. I think they're going to do this is not very different from I think they have done this. We think it follows from that
right.
case. But imagine that this jury concluded, yes, if there were not budget problems, the city would not have eliminated McDonald's job. They wouldn't have eliminated any jobs. And also, when it came to choosing who had to lose a job because of the budget problems, it was a retaliatory motive was the reason that Mary was picked. A jury instructed that they must find the retaliation to be the but-for cause. Might well say, oh, well, it wasn't the but-for cause. It was one of them. But there were other reasons. And so applying that jury instruction is literally written, they would conclude or could conclude we can't find for the plaintiff. Even though all of us would agree that if that was the fact pattern, if that's what happened, that the layoff was necessitated because of budget problems, but Mary was chosen because of her conduct, he believed she was helping her subordinates for a retaliatory motive, that's a violation of Title VII. I don't think there would be any dispute about that.
Well, let me ask you as to that example. Is that an argument that Instruction 16 was in error? Is that what you're saying? Because there's a possibility that there are at least two but-for causes, and if you say the but-for cause,
right.
but
if, yes,
all right. So if we were to decide, if we were to agree with you that renders Instruction 16 in error, what's your argument that it's reversible error? And do you have any authority?
Sure. This court has ruled in the Letterman case, 685 F3rd 1151, that erroneous instructions that go to the proof that the plaintiff must provide are almost always erroneous, require reversal. And the court said the standard is whether it might have impacted the jury verdict. That's all that's required. We cited that case in our opening brief on page 43. So, and this isn't just a minor error. I mean, I'll grant you that there's some language out of Nassar that if you, where they say the but for, but if you not only look at the holding in the last paragraph of the opinion, but think through the analysis they provided. They said this is a plain text. We require plain text reading of the statute. Well, the statute, the retaliation provision of Title VII doesn't say solely because of, it says because of. Okay, so if we're going to pay fidelity to the statute, we shouldn't be adding words. Nassar doesn't add words. It shouldn't be interpreted to imply a sole cause standard.
Did you tender an alternative instruction?
Well, yes, but we did, and it had a but for. We also argued, we asked for...
So the answer is yes.
Yes. And
what did your alternative instruction say?
In the combined set, we proposed a but for.
And that's the only difference between them was the A and the.
Right.
Okay.
The other thing is that the U.S. Supreme Court held in the McDonald case long ago that because Title VII does not say solely because of, that it's not a sole cause standard. I mean, that's a holding from the U.S. Supreme Court. If Nassar was making any kind of suggestion that it should be the but for as the
description. This argument, when you tendered your instruction, you actually argued this point to the court.
Now, we argued in the footnote that I highlighted the differences between the parties' positions.
Yes.
It said, the defendant says Nassar supports the but-for, and we say, no, the holding of Nassar says a but-for. Yes. I can just show you.
Well, but nobody stopped you from arguing A versus the. You had no prohibition against stressing to the jury that this was the reason.
I think that's...
And the court even allowed you to argue to the jury the perceived...
That's right.
So, I mean, you got a bad jury verdict.
Well...
And you think that
If you read the jury instruction... Yeah, the court said I can argue perceived, but if you read the jury instruction, it says I have to show that the retaliation was because Mary McDonald was interviewed. That's what the jury instruction says. So, I mean, I suppose I can argue anything I want to the jury, but I can't point to the jury to anything in the jury instructions that would allow that to fit. The jury instruction says, if you go look at that jury instruction...
Well, how literal do you think the jury is going to take where it says the as opposed to a?
Well...
I mean, here's what I have to say about that. Pardon?
We have cited to you many, many, many cases that say, if you say the but for, the proximate cause, the as the standard, it's reversible, period. And that is so well established that Prosser and Keaton note it in their treatise. The same treatise the Supreme Court in the Nassar case cited, in fact, the same section that they cited, the U.S. Supreme, Prosser and Keaton say that they're universally reversible if you say the. So it is prejudicial and it is harmful precisely because it's what it says. It suggests sole cause, and the standard of review here on a instruction that has to do with the burden is if it might have affected the jury's decision, it's reversible.
I'd like to ask you a question about the perception theory.
Yes.
Instruction, the one that you proposed and the court.
Yes.
Didn't give. Given that the Third Circuit, up to now, is the only circuit to recognize the perception theory, and it's an open question in this circuit, how did the district court abuse its discretion when it didn't agree to your proposed instruction?
Well, I think if the district court had ruled that it disagreed with that principle of law, that would not be an abuse of discretion. But that's not what the court did. The court even said we could argue it. The court then just didn't instruct on the law that the court agreed was the law. So we think that's the abuse of discretion. The court seemed to accept our argument that that's the law, but then failed to give an instruction that would really allow us to make the argument. I've got a minute and a half left.
I'm not sure I understand how that cuts. I mean, if the law is unsettled, whether court says that Third Circuit's right, wrong, or whatever, the fact is that it's unsettled in the Tenth Circuit, why wouldn't that insulate the court's instruction from reading.
Yeah, one second. If you stop the clock, and we'll have to proceed to answer Judge Matheson's question.
Okay.
You requested the time to rebut.
Well, I suppose it's an open question. I think that's a fair statement. I do think the Tenth Circuit has come as close as any other circuit to that Third Circuit opinion when it adopted a view that an anticipatory retaliation is recognized under the law. I don't think splitting the baby makes sense. It would be like adopting resolving the abortion debate by saying you can only have abortions on odd days of the week. It avoids the question. So. What I'm saying is, yes, the judge might have said the law is, I don't agree with you that this perceived instruction states the law. Or it could have said, I agree with you and properly instructed. What you can't do is say, I agree with you that it's right on the law, but I'm not going to give an instruction on it.
Well, did you present this theory at the pretrial, you know, in the pretrial order, the perceived?
Oh, boy. I think so, yeah. Yes, we did, yes.
Okay. I thought the court was under the impression this was an alternate theory.
I think the court thought that, too.
And was concerned that because the statute was so clear, that's why he did not give that instruction.
Yeah. I will come back ready to give you that cite.
Okay.
May it please the court, counsel. Ed Keeley, appearing on behalf of the defendants, appellees. I might note that really the only appellee that is here is the city, because the individual defendant Rebensdorf, the only claim against him was under 1983, and no appeal has been made as his judgment in 1983. But I'll continue to say defendants. But it's the title, the only claim at issue is the Title VII retaliation claim. And Judge Berzer made no error in jury instructions.
You say he did?
She did not.
Oh. Well, isn't the correct instruction a but-for cause, not the but-for cause?
In the abstract, but if you read the instruction number 16 here, there were two.
Well, let's talk about it in the abstract first. Is that the right way to instruct the jury? Is a but-for cause. How can it possibly be? You're not arguing that the retaliation had to be the sole cause.
No, never.
All right.
Never.
And the but-for cause connotes sole cause.
I don't agree with that. Because
you don't?
I don't believe it connotes
isn't
that.
Isn't the one cause?
I don't believe any jury is misled to believe that it's the sole cause. When you're talking about, first you say, one of the elements of defined retaliation here was that, and this is from Instruction 16, you have to find that but for the protected activity, the adverse action, here the elimination position, would not have occurred. And then there's the sentence about the but-for cause, which came out of Nassar and Gross. The Supreme Court has used those basically interchangeable. I would say that maybe...
Well, but didn't Justice Scalia, in a later case, in Barrage, make clear that the Title VII retaliation causation standard was not one of sole cause and that it was a but-for cause. It's exactly what was in the opinion. So there was a clarification after Nassar.
I believe that was in the context of a criminal case. Yes, he did say that.
But well, what about counsel's example? What if the jury the jury is thinking, well, there were these budget cuts.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the protected activity. Well, maybe the protected activity was the reason for the retaliation, or maybe it's the budget cuts. Maybe it was both, but we were told to find the but-for cause. I mean, why isn't that a problem?
Well, it isn't a problem when you take all the instructions as a whole. They were instructed on pretext. And the whole argument by plaintiffs down below, that's why I think this is a straw man argument on appeal. The whole argument below was that the city's reason of budget necessity was a pretext and wasn't the real reason. So that was what was argued. And they were given the pretext instruction that if you find, you are allowed to find that it was a pretext, and find that the real reason was the retaliation.
But is that a justification for the instruction, or is that more of a harmless error argument?
Well, I think, again, as this court has said many times, you take the instructions as a whole. Was the jury misled, or did they understand what they were asked to do was to find that the protected...
But isn't the problem that no matter how much we are told the jury understood, we don't know that. We don't know what the jury considered.
Well, we certainly do, based on their verdict form.
Well, sure. But we don't know if they did so because of a misinterpretation of the word "the" in the instruction, or a correct interpretation of the word "the."
Well, as this court has pointed out in Harley, where the trial judge used "the" and said "the but for" and "the reason," I find "the reason," this court said that was basically harmless error, no error there. It was clear what was meant.
Well, harmless error and error are two different things. I mean, okay. you can have error and it can be harmless. Was there error or not? I mean, whether it's harmless error comes later.
Our position was there was no error. First of all, it was a waiver. First of all, as they've admitted,
at the time that the alternative instruction was tendered, and the court no doubt gave you an opportunity to argue the instructions.
But they didn't. There was no argument made on that proposed instruction.
Well, he tendered an instruction. He tells us he tendered an instruction with the word "a."
Yes. But like in McKissick, where the plaintiff put in a footnote, an argument in a footnote in a response to a summary judgment motion, and then didn't argue it to the court beyond a footnote in the brief. I mean, we had an hour and a half of jury instruction conference with Judge Berzer, and we went instruction by instruction, and they never raised the A versus B argument then. They don't raise it. Or they don't even talk about it. Maybe that was forfeited, and that would be inadvertent. But if they were really upfront, they would have said to this court in their initial brief, "Hey, it looks like maybe we didn't raise that or argue that to the court, and so it's a plain error standard. And here's the elements of plain error and the standard of review." They don't argue that to this court. So it's clearly under Richardson and McKissick, the same situation. We don't even get to the but-for issue. I mean, it's clearly waived down below, and it's clearly waived in this court because they haven't preserved it. But if we want to talk about the merits, I mean, from going, if we don't don't believe it was error, but even if it was error, it wasn't reversible error. It was not abuse of discretion, as this court has pointed out. It was an open issue. It's still an open issue.
Wait a minute. You asserted that it's not reversible error. Can you give us an argument as to why it's not reversible error?
Well,
assuming it is error. And I know you don't think it is, but assuming for the sake of discussion.
Okay. It's not reversible error because it didn't change the verdict. It didn't change it's in effect a true statement of the law when you take everything in context. And when they're allowed to argue A versus B, in the closing arguments, I don't even think they made that argument. Because frankly, they hadn't argued to the court other than a proposed instruction. So the jury got and they were instructed on the basic.
Well, let me ask you this, because I was intrigued by Judge Kelly's question. about whether he argued that it should could be a but-for cause. He had counsel had tendered an instruction asking the court to instruct the jury that the word a should be used. So that obviously there could be other contributing causes to the termination, as long as this was one of the causes, or a substantial basis for the cause. You wouldn't fault counsel for not standing up and arguing to the jury that the didn't mean the, it meant a, when the court had refused him the instruction on that point.
Well, I would fault counsel for not, when we were discussing that particular instruction, which was proposed instruction number 5, for not saying, standing up and saying, hey, judge, there's this issue about A versus D. All that was argued was the perceived theory.
He asked you about the closing, not arguing before the judge.
Well, I guess I would still, if I'm in their shoes, and I really believe that it makes a difference.
Yes.
I would argue that, hey, you don't have to find that this is a sole cause. You don't have to find that this is that there's only one but for cause.
And then the judge interjects, that is not what I instructed.
I don't think she would have interjected.
Well, maybe not, but couldn't counsel be concerned that might be a risk to be making that argument in front of a jury?
No, because I think that is the argument. Because essentially, A and D, for purposes, at least until this Burris case, were interchangeable. They're interchangeable in Harley in this court. They were interchangeable in that Fifth Circuit case that I cited. Same argument. The same argument.
Which is the Fifth Circuit case?
Let's see. It's Fourth Circuit, the Gentry case. But no.
Yeah,
five.
But didn't in Gentry? Didn't the trial judge clarify to the jury that the but-for cause did not mean only or sole cause? That didn't happen here. That happened in Gentry, but that didn't happen here.
But the court says, I still think Gentry, which was a 2016 case, is still supporting of our position, and certainly Harley is. The Doe, our court, the Doe case, 2015, footnote 3, where our court, this court, affirmed jury verdict for the defendant, because the plaintiff failed to request a but-for instruction. I don't see how you arrive at the... They use the but-for, second sentence of a context, the right out of Nassar, second sentence, and you say, and it's purely speculation that the jury misunderstood what but-for meant when they were also...
I think that's the assertion here. The assertion is that the jury did not misunderstand what the word the meant.
Well, again, the does not mean sole cause. I think that's the bottom line.
I'm taking that comment, and let's be really careful about this. Is your position that sole cause is not the proper causation standard in this case?
Oh, absolutely. Sole cause would not be. If the instruction said sole cause, I would have objected to it. I mean, sole cause is obviously objectionable, but that's not what they were instructed of. And that's what, when Nassar and Gross were talking about but for and using A and B interchangeably, they weren't meaning sole cause, because obviously it would be to the Supreme Court that sole cause can't be the standard.
Counsel, could you give us a quick summary of your basic argument on the perceived participation instruction issue?
Okay. I think it basically, it, I think that Judge Berger was correct in, and did not abuse her discretion. I think that's the standard review. The perceived theory was essentially the same theory as the theory that the retaliation was because of the witness interview. It just backed it up to the complaint stage. That's the same claim. That's the same theory. And two, it was confusing the way they had worded it. Three, although factually it's stated in the pretrial order, it wasn't stated as a separate alternative claim. They're trying to make it a separate alternative claim, which would mean that even though, like this jury found, that the fact that plaintiff was interviewed as a witness on the co-worker's complaint, that wasn't the reason for the elimination position. But it was 5 months before that when the initial complaint came out. The argument I made to the trial court that, you know, Nassar is basically, it's an open question. And Fogelman, the Third Circuit, is the only one out there that's ever adopted it. But Nassar was very strict on its plain text arguments, rulings. So, it doesn't arise to abuse of discretion. I mean, it was argued. The trial court said you can argue it. It was argued. And it was all one proceeding. It was all this complaint by the coworker and not anything that was separate, alternative, stood alone kind of claim. So that there were certainly no error there.
He's out of time.
You're out of time.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
I noted myself. I'm sorry about that.
You're going to take my place.
I would have sent you back here. I'm used to having Judge Kelly preside, but I'm not Judge Kelly.
Judge Kelly, I promised you that I'd give you a cite, and it's page 4 of the pretrial order, AB 47, and we articulated that we believed factually that Mr. Riebensdorf was believed that Mary had helped this subordinate. Okay. And that was part of our case.
Now, how does that square with the statute? And when the court is looking at instructions, and the statute says it shall be unlawful, et cetera, to discriminate against any of his employees because he has assisted or participated in an investigation under this subchapter. Not that the employer erroneously thought claimed that he was participating.
And my answer to that is that if we were going to read it that strictly, this court's prior decision in that Sauer case is wrong. So apparently that's not what we do. The anticipatory retaliation.
Well, but that's
case.
A different factual.
Well, of course,
situation.
But your point, strictly narrowly reading the statute, would mean that case is wrong.
All right.
Waiver. It was not only an alternative instruction given, joint instruction submitted to the court with a footnote. And yes, it's a footnote, but the footnote's where the arguments are.
Well,
it's not a footnote to
up?
An argument, it is the argument.
Counsel, why didn't you get up at the time of your arguing the instructions and say, well, wait a minute, what about this point? Why didn't you why don't we put in A and not the?
Because the court basically said we didn't need to.
Well, but you didn't need to because it was an unsettled issue.
Well, but the way this hearing went, because the parties had submitted joint instructions.
But they didn't agree on it.
Right. But the court came and then asked questions. It wasn't like run through your objections, you run through your objections. The court asked questions and then said, nobody's waiving
okay.
anything.
But let me ask you this then. After the jury went out to deliberate, by statute, you have an opportunity to object to instructions that were given. Did you?
No, we did not.
All right.
We felt these issues had been presented to the court. The court made a decision, and there was no point belaboring it. The court had made clear, look, I've read all this stuff. I've reviewed it. I'm making my decision,
well,
and you don't need to keep making objections.
Courts always say that.
Sure.
But you've got to pin them down.
Well, the court, and that, the court, that doesn't mean you waive. That's what she said. She told us that.
All right.
I'd like to end with...
I think you're out of time.
Oh, am I?
You're not only out of time, but you're out of the same amount
very
of time
good.
As your friend here was out of
thank
time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. The case is submitted. Counsel are excused.